Underworld, Disc 12.
Manx Martin. Chapter 2. The super comes gimping toward him. Before he takes 5 steps along the street, the super comes gimping toward him from a building down the block, moving with that hip lurch of his that takes up half a sidewalk.
"Been looking for you," the man says.
Manx Martin stands with folded arms, not bothering to cock his head just yet, a little early for gestures of the superior type.
"You seen those shovels?"
"What shovels?" Manx says.
"Because they're missing out of the basement."
"Things always missing. Bought a pair of new socks missing in the wash."
"2 snow shovels from the utility room standing against the wall this morning."
"We expecting snow?" Manx says. And he looks heavenward. "Look like snow to you? Don't look like snow to me. Weatherman say snow?"
"Gone by noon, right out the door. And I'm asking up and down the street."
"You ought to be more careful who you ask, because some people touchy on the subject."
"I'm asking you, because I hear things."
The super is wearing a light shirt in this chill. Manx smells the change of season, the bite of wet and the cutting wind, and the man standing here with his sleeves rolled up. Getting on in years, the super, with stubble speckled a little white.
"Somebody tells me straight out," he says to Manx. "Talk to the klepto."
"You're saying to my face."
"I'm saying what I hear."
"Who you hear it from?"
"And I'm saying those shovels worth good money. Those are tools I need to do my job. Those blades, understand? Try pushing snow with a coal shovel."
Manx is surprised by the super's attitude, knocked a little off balance. The super seems determined. Should be the landlord's problem. Why run around doing detective work? Let the landlord go into his pocket for replacements. Those pockets so deep the man's knees get skinned by rattling change. Someone stands on the corner preaching to the wind. Manx is also surprised by the super's forearms. Got some strength in those arms. Wrestling garbage cans, you know, rolling the cans diagonal across the pavement.
"I think you got your business backwards," Manx says. "Because what we see in this block of buildings is buildings getting robbed, not shovels getting robbed. They breaking in left and right."
"I'm telling you what I hear."
"And I'm saying this is the thing you ought to be occupying your time. Jimmy guards on the doors."
"I find out you took those shovels. I go to the landlord and you're out on the street, brother."
Awful bigoted for a cripple.
"Because he will listen when I talk."
Most janitors around here are floaters, who work in one neighborhood, then another. Come and go, staying one step ahead of something. This man's dug in like infantry.
"You and me, we're through passing the time," he says. "You show up at my door with a shovel in your right hand and a shovel in your left, then I listen to what you say."
Manx cocks his head and makes his eyes go tight in phonied concentration. He's looking to stare the man down, put the man in his place. But the super pushes on past. Manx is leaning into the man, but the man pushes on past, clumsily, every step a contortion and a labor. And Manx is phased once more. He was just getting set to make a major statement. He walks over to Amsterdam Avenue. 3 kids run by, going like hellfire, and he sees Frenzo Cooper in a suit and tie, standing by the shoe repair.
"Who died? You're all dressed up, Frenzo."
Turning as he speaks, wanting one last look at the super, he's not sure why, to shoot a beam of evil, maybe.
"You see my brother?"
Frenzo says. He's wearing a hat with a little feather in the band, and his shoes have a military shine. The neon shoe is out of juice.
"I'm going to Tally's." "You see him, tell him I need his car."
"Who died, Franzo?"
"I need to go to Jersey to see a lady, else I die. What are you doing?" Nothing much. I die of lovesick, man. Tell him to get over here with that junk heap. Be worth his while.
There's the beauty school, the shoe repair, the furnished rooms, and over the door of the shoe repair there's a neon high shoe. And the neon he sees is dark and cold, which brings him down a ways, a little sag in his mood. The traffic stops and rolls at the corner, rolls on into the night, and a man stands by the rib joint preaching. Three or four people stop a minute and get the drift, and stand another minute and go where they're going. And two or three others come and listen and leave, and the cars roll past, and the light changes, and the cars roll on. The preacher says,
"They say that only insects survive."
He's an old man with a hungry head, veined at the temples, and his hands are coming out of his sleeves. The sleeves of his jacket are so shrunk down that you can see, way up his wrists, long, flat fingers marking his words, and bicycle clips on his pants. Three kids race by, like fleeing the scene.
"This is what they say, and I believe 'em, because they studied the matter. All the creatures God put on Earth, only insects survive the radiation. They're scientists studying the cockroach every second of his life. They watch him when he sleeps. He comes through a crack in the wall. There's a man with a magnifying glass been waiting since dawn. And I believe them when they say the insects still be here after the atom bombs will fell the buildings and destroy the people and kill the birds and the animals and masculate the dogs and cats so they can't beget their young. I believe them in and out and up and down. But I also got news for them. I know this before they do. We all know this, standing here right now, because we veterans of a particular place. Do we need somebody telling us how insects survived the blast? Don't we know this from the morning we born? I'm talking to you. Nobody here needs scientific proof that insects be the last living things. They already pretty close. We dying all the time. These roaches still climbing the walls and coming out the cracks."
Manx glances back the other way. He'd like to get one last look at the super to nourish his grudge. People stop to get the street preacher's drift, six or seven folks standing in the wind. Manx looks at the old man in his cuffed pants like some uniform a boy invents, playing army. There's something thin-skulled about him. His head is naked and veined and papery. A man listens, interested, in a French hat, a black beret, and two women in those sister outfits, Sister So-and-so from the storefront church, glad to meet you, with napkins on their heads and frown faces.
"Nobody knows the day or the hour."
Two men in suits and their well-dressed wives. The men want to listen. The ladies say, "No thanks. Cockroach talk is not their deedly-dee."
"Russians explode an atom bomb on the other side of the world. You got your radio tuned to the news? I'm telling you the news. Clear across the world. And you're standing there saying, 'Don't mean nothing to me.' Old business, you're saying. The business of generals and diplomats. But right now, this here minute, while I'm talking and you're listening, officials making plans to build bomb shelters all over this city. Building bomb shelters that hold 25,000 people under the streets of this city. And guess what you don't hear on today's news? You have to stand in the wind and hear it from me. Every one of those people standing in those shelters while the bomb's raining down is a white person. I'm talking to you. Because not one single shelter's being built in Harlem. All right. They're putting shelters on the Upper East Side. They're putting shelters down lower 6th Avenue. They're sheltering 42nd Street, all right. They're putting shelters out in Queens, all right. They're sheltering Wall Street deep and dry. A-bombs raining from the sky. What are you supposed to do? Take a bus downtown?"
Manx has a faint grin. A girl's standing there with her boyfriend, and she says,
"He's an agitator, let's go."
Manx can appreciate the man's argument, but it's a little removed. The argument is satisfying because it's the multiplying into millions of the little do's and don'ts he carries around every day. She says,
"He's an agitator, let's go."
But it's the do's and don'ts he has to live with, not the news of the world with that rooster that goes scraw, scraw in the movie house down the street. The man's still talking, standing tall and with a whippy kind of bend in his body, a head like a hatched egg that's all veined out, and three kids race by, and a face so naked you think you've known him all your life, pants cuffed tight, and some kids race by.
"Where's your bicycle, man?"
And the boyfriend's got his cap slung low, not moving from the spot, and the girlfriend's saying,
"He's an agitator, let's go."
The man's swiveling his head to catch an eye somewhere.
"They say stop paying rent. I don't say stop paying rent. I don't say blow up the gas and electric, the power and light. They say walk the landlords to the river. I don't say walk the landlords to the river, stand them up against the wall. I say take a dollar bill out of your pocket where it's folded up tight because you've been saving it for this and that. Unfold this dollar bill and turn it over to the back side where they keep their secret messages. They keep their Latin words and their Roman numbers."
And the man takes a wadded bill out of his pocket and unfolds it like a magic trick. And then he waves the money at the group in front of him.
"You see the eye that hangs over this pyramid here? What's pyramids doing on American money? You see the number they got strung out at the base of this pyramid? This is how they flash their Masonic codes to each other. This is Freemason, the passwords and handshakes. This is Rosicrucian, the beam of light. This is webs and scribbles all over the bill, front and the back, that contains a message. This is not just rigmarole and cooked spaghetti. They predict in the day and the hour. They're telling each other when the time has come. You can't find the answer in the Bible or the Bill of Rights. I'm talking to you. I'm saying history is written on the commonest piece of paper in your pocket."
And he holds the bill by its edges and extends his elbows, showing the thing for what it is.
"I've been studying this dollar bill for 15 years. Take it to the privy when I do my hygiene. And I work those numbers and those letters all which way. And I hold the bill to the light, and I read it underwater. And I'm getting closer every day to breaking the code."
Then he draws the dollar to his chest and folds it 5 times and puts it in his pocket, smaller than a postage stamp.
"This is why they're watching me with that eye that floats over the top of the pyramid. They're watching and they're following all the time."
Manx needs a drink. He hurries up Amsterdam past a TV radio store, where a TV is flickering and half a dozen people are watching in the cold. About a block away, he sees some guys running toward him. Grown men, you know, pounding over the sidewalk, over the iron hatchways that lead to storage cellars, rattling the metal as they come. And he sees they're sort of half laughing. They're embarrassed. Must be a crap game down an alley that the police broke up. And they go past him rattling the hatchways and looking back, running and half laughing and looking back. He almost wants to turn around and run with them. He sees the humor of it. They'll meet in some doorway 3 blocks away, laughing and panting and catching their breath, feeling grown up stupid. And they'll find a place to do their gambling, the back room of a barber shop, or someone's living room if the wife's not there. But the wife is there. Because I got a wife can't stand the sight of me, even if I'm 10 miles away, and will not let me breathe without a comment, and makes more comments in her head, and she is definitely there. A dog looks out a first-floor window. Yeah. Black man running in the streets. Manx found himself running in the 43 riot. And he probably had the same look on his face. Conscious of being caught up in something he shouldn't be doing, but doing it anyway. Running past Orkin's, where Ivy bought a sample coat. A coat a dummy used to wear, on sale, cheap. And it rankled his mind, all right. And all the Orkin's dummies were on the sidewalk now. Torsos tumbled in the gutter, and heads without bodies, and slim necks and pale hair, and dummies armless like famous statues. He recalls this now, the big windows busted, and dummies in garters, dummy legs and stockings and garters, and kids in tuxedos. Men running in the streets, and a kid maybe 12 years old in a top hat and looted tux, and a cop was leading him to a prowl car. Funniest damn thing, top hat and tails and dragging pants. Even the cop had a sweetheart smile. He goes the last four blocks with his head turned away from the wind, and the wind is whipping off the Hudson, and Manx is walking like a horse with a spooked head. But how different once you step inside the bar. The warm buzz, the easy breathing, the rumps happy on their stools. The buzz in Tally's is special tonight. More bodies than the usual midweek slump, and more static in the air. And then he remembers. There's a tone, a telling rustle in the room, and he pats the side of his jacket and feels the baseball and understands that they're talking about the game. He waves to Phil, who's behind the bar, Tally's brother, in his plain shirt and fancy suspenders, and he gestures a question, "Where?" And Phil nods toward the far corner, and there is Antoine Cooper sitting with a drink in front of him, and two tall shovels leaned on the wall behind. Manx sits across from Antoine, sits sideways in his chair so he doesn't have to look at the shovels. "I seen Franzo standing in the dark."
"I know it. He wants my car, but he can't have it."
"What's that you're drinking?"
"He's looking to make some chick he's better off avoiding. Trust me, I already done her."
Manx looks around the room, takes in the buzz, hears half a sentence fly up out of shared laughter, and he decides not to mention the shovels. He is aghast at the shovels. The shovel should not be here in any manner, way, shape, or form. But he decides for now he won't say a word.
"What was that riot in 43? I'm trying to recall how it started. They filled so many holding cells and so many station houses, they had to open an armory."
43. I'm in the army, man."
"They had bleeding men carrying their loot under armed guard. Put them in an armory on Park Avenue."
"We had our own riot," Antoine says.
Manx goes to the bar and gets a Seagram's from Phil. He likes his rye in a short glass with a single ice cube. Phil says,
"What's happening?" "I hear they played a ball game today." "Goddamn, it was something."
Manx carries the drink back to the table with one hand clutching the glass in the usual manner, and the palm of the other hand under the glass, supporting it like some polished object in a church. The ice cube is mainly scenery. Antoine says,
"How's the boys doing?"
"The boys? The boys spread far and wide," Manx says. "Randall's in the south somewhere, bivouacking, you know. Training in the field. And Vernon?"
"I know where Vernon's at."
"Vernon's on the front lines where he's at. They got 250,000 troops they're looking at across the line. Them Chinese."
"What division he's with?"
"What division?"
"Second Infantry's in Korea," Antoine says.
"I don't know what division."
"You don't follow the war?"
"What's that you're drinking?"
"I like to follow the war. They plot their strategies."
"They blow horns and whistles. That's their strategy, them Chinese. They come charging down in swoops."
"This here's brandy, my man. Drinking imported tonight."
"It's sitting there a little potent,"
Mank says. Only in the glass. Goes down the hatch real smooth.
They come in swoops. That's their strategy.
You say a prayer now and then. That's what you do.
Sure, Antoine. I kneel by the bedside.
You done okay with your kids?
Sure, Antoine. They take care of me in my old age.
You got some work?
They come visit me and the old folks. Slip me a bottle through the gate.
You done okay, considering.
Rosie's the one. That's a great girl. That's the only one that shows respect.
You need some work. Change your temperament around. You walking on legs lately.
They're laying off. They're not hiring, they're laying off.
You need to get into long-distance moving.
They bring me a cake on my birthday,
Mank says. Long distance, that's the ticket. I got a cousin in Alabama, but she's based in Birmingham. Gets plenty of work long-hauling furniture and whatnot.
I keep that in mind.
Yellow yams from Birmingham.
I place that on my list of things I need to think about.
Greenest greens you ever seen, Antoine says, a little croony.
Manx decides he can't contain it any longer. But he doesn't look at Antoine. He looks across the room at one of those wall lamps. The old-fashioned type lamp bracketed to the wall where the sleeves that hold the bulbs have fake candle wax running down the sides. And he says,
Shit, man, you got those shovels in plain sight.
Antoine has a long, slick head and narrow neck. A man of schemes and contrivances, called Snake when he was younger. And he determines it is necessary to turn his upper body to the wall behind him so he can identify the objects in question.
Oh, yeah, these things for shoveling off the patio after a white Christmas.
And he turns back to Manx real low in his chair so he's peering out confidentially over his drink.
I don't think there's an FBI bulletin circulating tri-state. What do you think?
I think they belong in your car, like we stated.
The point is, you got to raise your sights, because these things don't bring no return.
We stated beforehand, Antoine.
Not worth arguing. You're right, I'm wrong. But you got to raise your sights.
They sit drinking a while, and Manx thinks about leaving, but he doesn't move off the chair. He thinks about taking his shovels and leaving, but he sits there. Because once he gets up and takes the shovels off the wall, he is committed to walking the full length of the barroom with two large snow shovels in early October, and no place sensible to take them. And the thought of it, and the sight of it, keeps his ass in the chair. Instead, he takes out the baseball and sets it on the table. Then he waits for Antoine to take some time out of his busy day so he can notice.
My kid brought it home from the game. My youngest says it's the home run that won the game.
That game they played today?
That's right,
Mank says. I seen people on 7th Avenue hollering up and down, hands pressed on their horns, hollering out the window. I said to Willie Mabry, you know Willie, I said, they must be opening the vaults. The bank's opening up their vaults. First come, first serve, I said. Let's go get ours.
My youngest, he come home with the ball. This is the ball, what's his name, hitting the stands. The game winner. Win the pennant.
Manx feels uneasy. He feels separated from what he's saying. It comes out of his mouth like a lie. The way a lie hangs in the air, independent of right and wrong, making you feel you're not responsible. He feels an urge to take the ball off the table and put it back in his pocket.
This is the ball, what's his name? What are you saying, exactly?
I'm saying it could be worth something.
And I'm saying raise your sights, because a circumstantial fact, you can't prove nothing. And who do you sell it to, anyway?
I sell it to the ball club. They want it for a trophy. They make a display.
Let me look at this thing. This thing's all smudged up.
Manx realizes he doesn't want Antoine to touch the ball. Antoine will look at the ball and say something that's a bring-down,
something that gets Manx riley and griped, and he's already feeling tense enough with his stomach acting up. He takes the ball and puts it in his pocket. Antoine leans back, hands up and palms facing out, showing his old snakehead smile, cool and mean.
Tell you something. Maybe you sell the thing somewhere. But I don't think you'd be buying a sofa from Ludwig Baumann's, he says, or a pretty dinette.
Manx goes to the bar to drink in peace. After a while, Phil comes over, and they talk a while. The place is quieter now, down to serious drinkers. They talk about the game. Phil is a straight-up guy, barn-sized, looks you in the eye. He talks about the game, and Manx listens carefully, hoping for an angle, something to go on. The Dodgers are finished for the year, dead and buried. The Giants play in the World Series starting tomorrow. Starting today, Phil says, checking his watch, because it's past midnight now.
Who are they playing in the series?
Yankees, who else?
All New York, in other words.
All New York series. And people already lining up for tickets. Heard it on the radio. All night they'd be lining up. Sleeping bags, you know. I'd love to go myself.
All night?
Manx says.
People do anything to see this series. The way the Giants got in?
Manx likes the sound of that. People do anything. He tells Phil to pour one for himself, knowing the man will decline. He always declines. And Manx feels a little snake-like. Caught it from Antoine. He goes back to the table with a little shuffle in his step.
You leave your brother standing in the cold.
I know it, Antoine says.
He wants a car one night is all.
I'm doing him a favor, because that lady he's looking to make is all kinds of two-faced.
Let him find out for himself. He's a young guy looking for some action.
See, you're not a jealous man. Let me explain something. I'm a jealous man. When I say jealous, I mean the full meaning of the word. Everybody jealous, Antoine says. Word don't mean shit unless you give it the full meaning. It needs an adjective, like crazy jealous, or can't think straight jealous. So if I say I'm jealous, you have to picture eyeballs filled with blood.
You already done with her. What do you care? He's a good boy, Franzo. Let him learn.
Let him find out, you mean, because he won't learn nothing.
But Antoine seems to soften. He eases toward the tabletop, elbows spread, his chin nearly touching the brandy glass.
Yeah, I like that boy a lot. He's a good boy, Franzo. But I got my car in an awkward position.
You wrap it around a pole?
You know Willie Mabry?
Don't think so,
Manx says.
Willie and I have been talking about my car. A way to make some fast cash. I ain't broke, per se, but I can use some hurry in my income.
Sipping his brandy.
And this here's my first payment in advance. Go down smooth, the cream de la cream.
Payment for what?
Willie opened a restaurant about 6 weeks ago. Doing okay, but he's got a problem with his garbage. The city's talking about private companies coming in to pick up this trash, but right now the city does it. And there's an ordinance about what time of day or night a restaurant can leave garbage on the street. You can't leave it there all night.
Smells bad.
Smells bad? Attracts vermin? And if you keep it on the premises, you have a situation where the rat's talking to the customers.
So you made an arrangement with the man?
Me and my car, both.
Which this reminds me, Manx says. You mind giving me a lift?
Take you anywhere, Antoine says.
They drain their glasses and get up and sort of shake themselves out, shake off the complacent airs and humors of the tavern, and re-arouse themselves for whatever's out there,
the edgy, wind-spooked street. Antoine gets into his jacket and rolls his shoulders and zips the jacket to the throat. He cuffs his nuts for good measure, aligning for comfort and symmetry, placing them squarely at the center of the world. Manx is already wearing his jacket. He never took his jacket off. He's been wearing his jacket since he left the house in the morning. Drinking in it, eating dinner in it, washing the dinner dish. And he zips it to the throat and sinks into the hull, the shell, already a little lightweight for the season. They wave to Phil on the way out, and they walk down to the end of the block where the car is parked. Manx goes around to the passenger side and puts his hand on the door handle, and then he stops and looks. Antoine says, "Get in, man. Faster you get in, faster we move. Where you want to go?" Manx is looking. He looks in the window at the rear seat, and it is filled with garbage. He'd smelled it when he walked down the street, but this is not an unoccurring smell, and he took it for the general thing it was. Garbage in an alleyway or empty lot. Now he sees it is Antoine's car that smells. It is Antoine's car packed with mounds of ripe trash. Oh, man. Sheesh. I misdescribed this in my mind because I thought, "Get in, man. Friggin' cold tonight." There is garbage in paper bags and cardboard boxes. There are two metal garbage cans wedged between the front and rear seats, regulation street-size cans, with dented tops sort of erupted up by the pressure. Manx sees garbage stowed on the ledge by the rear window. He sees front seat garbage in a peach crate, smack on the seat, the oozy smell so near you can drink it. "I thought you were on your way to get the man's trash and take it somewhere."
"Took it here. Trash right here. I filled up the trunk while they were still eating the dinner. Then I started on the inside of the car, working back seat to front seat. Move the crate and get in."
Manx opens the door and sets the peach crate on the mat and sits down, trying to find room for his feet on either side of the crate.
"Where you want to go?" Antoine says.
"Not far, but fast. Up by 155th Street. Where are you taking this stuff?"
"Drive it to the Bronx. There's a tar garbage under the Whitestone Bridge somewhere. I fling the trash out the door and press the gas pedal hard."
"You do me a favor and press it now," Manx tells him, "because I'm about to die sitting here conferring."
"Be calm. I'll take you where you're going."
Antoine puts the vehicle in motion. He drives steady and unfazed, pointing the car up Broadway like a poisoned dart. Manx realizes this is why the snow shovels were not in the car, where he told Antoine to put them. No room for shovels in the car. Then he realizes they left the shovels in the bar room. Good a place as any. Except they won't be there tomorrow, so cross that little caper off the slate. The last thing he realizes is that Antoine's been telling him all night to raise his sights, and him driving a DeSoto full of garbage.
"You drop me just up ahead there."
"I take you exactly where you're going."
"Broadway be fine," Manx says.
The stink is killing him, lifting him out of the insulated state of a day's slow whiskey burn. The trash is bumping and mashing around, and it has a life of its own, a kind of seething vegetable menace that pushes up out of the cans and boxes. It's noisy and restless. Or maybe that's just the vermin moving around on the verge of being carsick.
"This here's fine," Max says, "right at the corner."
"You're not going to tell me where you're going?"
"I tell you where you're going if you want to take this trash to the Whitestone Bridge. You cross the river and get on 161st, which I think it runs two ways, and you take it to Bruckner, you be okay, Boulevard."
Antoine looks at him. Manx is already out of the car and is standing on the sidewalk, and Antoine looks at him, sitting unfazed at the wheel, a long, lazy, snake-eye look.
or I could dump it in the street.
That's what I thought. That's what I said to myself.
While the city sleeps, Antoine says, and the cops be eating their chowder.
Max watches the car move off. The feel of empty streets after midnight, and the wind off the Hudson as he walks east, the hawk at his back, the cutting wind that sends loose trash skidding in the street.
Could be Antoine unleashing early.
He'd like to see an Alka-Seltzer, is what he'd like to see, sizzling down the length of a cold glass of water. He walks down the long ramp with the ballpark on his left, the polo grounds, and he looks for people standing in line or huddle on the pavement with blankets and food, the all-nighters, the men and boys eager for tickets, the kids who get paid by scalpers to stand in the cold and buy tickets that desperate fans will haggle over next day, paying prices out of sight. The place is deadly still. And Manx has a stale, acid feeling, that fidgety indigestion where you drink too much on an empty stomach, even though he knows he ate a meal. He recalls the dish Ivy left him. He tastes the meatloaf and greens. But there's a wrenching pull, like he's all sucked dry. He's down on 8th Avenue now, wandering the perimeter of the ballpark, looking for a sign that someone's still alive. The place is stone-cold quiet. What's a pyramid doing on a U.S. bill? That's a question you'd do well to ask. The only thing he sees is a dog of the slinking type. Been kicked so often, it decides it's being petted. He can't understand how Phil could be wrong about this. Phil's a straight-up guy. If Phil says the fans will be lining up all night to buy tickets, and then you go there and look around and the place is deadly still, you have to wonder who's messing with your head. It is, frankly, a fly-by-night moving in storage. They call him and he works. They don't and he don't. Now he sees a car stop for a light, and he walks on over, sliding his feet the way he does when things get culminated on him. A man sits at the wheel. He sees Manx coming and rolls up the window, a white man with a look on his face like, I ain't ready to die. Manx makes a motion with his hands. He shakes his hands in the air. No, 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 no. I only want to ask a question. And the man hits the pedal and he's gone. Never mind, the light's still red. Burning rubber, real impressive. The sound dies into the night stillness and a deep quiet comes on again. The old ballpark stands over the avenue and makes its own enormous silence, different from the street and the river. Kids still swim in the Harlem River in the summer, way uptown, where it turns out of the Hudson. And his own boys used to leap off a dock, arms all flung. He sees them momentarily in midair. It grieves the bejesus out of him. He feels a little empty. He feels low and put off, and frankly, humanly disgusted. And he wants to lie down and sleep. He feels a little messed with. He wants to, somehow, from someone, make some money. One chance in 10 million the ball club even lets him in the door. He has to find the paying fans. And he only walked toward the car to ask where they are. And the face at the wheel, like, don't cut me up in little pieces, please. He looks across 155th Street, south to the tenements, and he sees a woman standing under the Power of Prayer sign, soliciting her trade. He hears a sound across the river. What's the point of all the secret codes on a U.S. dollar, except to disconnect you from the people who know the facts? He hears something. He's ready to head home. There's nowhere to go but home unless he finds another bar. And he knows he has to go down the subway and wait for a train and an empty station, another bring down. Stand there on the long platform waiting, half an hour maybe. And he hears a sound from across the river, far away but clear, the way voices travel exact on the water at night. He stands near the bridge approach and listens. Men singing. The sound of a great many voices.
some following behind the others, rambunctious and uneven. And he knows the tune. They're singing, riding on a pony. They're singing, stuck a feather in his cap. They're singing, called it macaroni. And he hears laughter drift across the river and begins to understand, finally. It wasn't the bartender who made the mistake. Phil never said the people would be lining up at the polo grounds. He never named the ballpark. It was Manx who made the mistake, because they're lining up at Yankee Stadium just across the river. It's the Giants versus the Yankees at Yankee Stadium. And the voice has traveled so exact, it's like someone's whispering just to him. He hears a group of fans chanting, "Say hey, Willie!" And of course those are Giant fans, and that's Willie Mays. They're singing his praises. And he hears the answering chant from the Yankee fans with that old Jolting Joe DiMaggio song from before the war. He thinks that they were playing on every radio in the country. "We want you on our side." And it's all rough and tumble and good-natured, and his mood picks up. And he gives the ball a smack with the palm of his hand where it's tucked in his jacket pocket, the perfect roundness and hardness of an object that's substantial. He walks across the swing bridge and hears them in the streets. And then he begins to see them. They're walking across the public park to the stadium, across the fields and pathways, and they're coming down from the elevated train, men and boys in long streams, turning the bends in the high stairways, and they're laughing and singing. He sees flags waving on the stadium roof and World Series bunting hung high on the outer wall. He sees fires on the pavement. They're building fires in 55-gallon drums. And he is struck a little dumb by the masses of people out to buy tickets at this time of night. His mouth hangs a little open, and he is wide-eyed dumb. He paces himself to the crowd, feeling pulled along, feeling frankly happy to be among them. And they're carrying food and chairs, web chairs for the beach that fold up light. And they have sleeping bags strapped to their backs. A dozen college boys with their hair clipped short, and they're passing thermos bottles that smoke up when you screw off the lid. Strong coffee to keep them awake and warm. He sees fathers and sons standing around the fires to warm themselves. Masses of people, if you could count them, and mounted police with horses breathing steam. And he feels a rare elation, a wanting to be among them. And he's pulled along a little slack-jawed, because it's a great thing to see. And they're singing, roaring, warring songs. They're back and forthing on the street with rough-and-tumble humor, all these ball fans striding toward the ticket lines at 2 or 3 in the morning, or whatever the actual hour. Manx is wearing a watch that stopped running 6 weeks ago. This is a situation he will direct his attention to when his life gets back to being regular. Part 4. Cocksucker Blues. Summer, 1974. Chapter 1. It was the rooftop summer. Drinks or dinner, a wedged garden with a wrought-iron table that spored along its curved legs with oxide blight. And maybe those are old French roses climbing the chimney pot, a color called maiden's blush, or a long terrace with a slate surface and birch trees in copper tubs, and the laughter of a dozen people sounding small and precious in the night, floating over the cold soup toward skylights and domes and water tanks. Or a hurry-up lunch, an old friend, beach chairs and take-out Chinese, and how the snapdragons smell buttery in the sun. This was Clara Sachs's summer at the roofline. She found a hidden city above the grid of fever streets. Walk and don't walk, 10 million bobbing heads that ride above the tideline of taxi stripes, all brain-waved differently. And yes, the street abounds in idiosyncrasy, in the human veer. But you have to go to roof level to see the thing distinct,
preserved in masonry and brass. She looked across the crowded sky of ventilators and antennas, and suddenly there's a quirk, some unaccountable gesture that isolates itself. Angels with butterfly wings tucked under a cornice on Bleecker Street. Or the mystery of a white clapboard cottage on the roof of an office building. Or the odd deco heads, sort of Easter Islandish, attached to the corners of a midtown tower. She found these things encouraging. Dozens such that hung unauthored, with bridge cables in the distance and occasional booming skies, the false storms of summer. She was 54 now. Let that number rumble in your head. 54. And between projects, and humanly invisible, and waiting to go back to work, to make and shape and modify and build. The World Trade Center was under construction, already towering, twin towering, with cranes tilted at the summits and work elevators sliding up the flanks. She saw it almost everywhere she went. She ate a meal and drank a glass of wine and walked to the rail or ledge, and there it usually was, bulked up at the funneled end of the island. And a man stood next to her one evening, early, drinks on the roof of a gallery building. About 60, she thought, portly and jowled, but also sleek in a way, assured and contained and hard-polished, a substantial sort, European. I think of it as one, not two, she said. Even though there are clearly two towers, it's a single entity, isn't it?
Very terrible thing, but you have to look at it, I think.
Yes, you have to look. And they were out of ideas for a while, standing at the ledge and taking in the baleful view together, uncomfortably, she thought, because aesthetic judgments feel superficial when you share them with a stranger. And finally she sensed a rustle, a disturbance in his bearing that was meant to mark a change of subject, earnest and determined, and he said to her, still looking toward the towers, he whispered, actually, I like your work, you know.
Yes?
Very sympathetic.
It was so humid some nights you couldn't close your door. You had to shoulder your door closed. Bridges expanded and sidewalks cracked, and there was garbage in the streets, and you had to sort of talk to your door before it would close for you. She loved the nights that were electrical, a static in the air, and lightning in soft pulses, in great shapeless beats. You can almost read the rhythmic pattern, slow and protoplasmal. And maybe a Cinzano awning fixed to a table on a higher terrace. You can't identify that gunshot sound until you spot the striped awning edges snapping in the breeze. Clara was happy in a guarded way, keeping it folded close. She had a sense of being favored, fairly well regarded for recent work, feeling good again after a spell of back pain and insomnia, clear-minded after a brief depression, saving her money after a spending spree, getting out and seeing friends and standing at parapets, quietly happy, looking better than she had in years. They all said so. It was the time of Nixon's fall from office, but she didn't enjoy it the way her friends did. Nixon made her think of her father, another man of frazzled mind, rehearsed in his very step, his physical address, bitter and distant at times, with a loser's bent frame, all head and hands. She stood at parapets and wondered who had worked the stones, shaped these details of the suavest nuance, chevrons and rosettes, urns on balustrades, the classical swags of fruit, the scroll brackets supporting a balcony. And she thought they must have been immigrants, Italian stone carvers probably, unremembered. Artists anonymous of the early centuries, buried in the sky. She wasn't used to being recognized. She was recognized in certain situations, but only rarely.
and it made her feel that someone was taking measurements of her body in a small, mirrored room. She tended to be unseen, except by friends. She was mostly invisible, humanly invisible to people in the market down the street, and not just youngsters hurrying past a hazy shape in the aisles. The unfocused stuff of middle age, but people in general. Okay, men in general, who gave her generic status at best. It wasn't an issue. She wasn't lonely or unloved. No, she was unloved in the deeper senses of the word, but that was fine. She'd had enough love of the deeper types, painful and ever-echoing. The rancorous marriages that made it hard for you to earn a dependable solitude. It was a curiosity only, and a bracing form of self-awareness, learning to be unseen. Miles Lightman came around a lot that summer. There was something about Miles that made her think he ate off dirty dishes, but she began to get used to him, to like him a lot. He was kinetic and unreflective, essentially artless, blank to the schemes of conceit that ruin many a budding love. She wore long, ruffled skirts. She wore denim skirts with floriated hems. She stood on the roof of a factory building, a space made available for the evening so that a small theater group might launch a fun drive. And 50 people drank tepid wine out of plastic cups and said, "We need theater." She was near the ledge talking to a woman she didn't know, and at some point she understood that the building she was facing, about 10 blocks uptown, an oldish tower with a massed midsection and mosaic summit, was the Fred F. French Building. And she tried to listen to the woman but couldn't concentrate because the name lit up her brain. One of those deep, sheer flashes that take 40 years to happen. Fred F. French. She had to tell the story to Miles because it was funny and screwy, and she wanted to give in to it completely. Get it out and work it around and pile on the details. Boy crazy Rochelle and the horny boy in the back seat. And she was in it too, of course. Clara Sachs without the X. How she walked and talked. How things were real and she was real in ways she'd forgotten how to be. From the tall windows of her loft, she saw fire escapes angled and stepped. This was her principal view. Dark metal structures intersecting in depth over the back alleys. And she wondered if these lines might tell her something. Lofts were maybe dangerous, she thought, but not for fires. Spacious and pillared and memoried and grand. She had to watch for ego creeping in. She had to ask herself, would you do this piece a truer way if you worked in a stunted garret somewhere? She tried to scale her work to the human figure, even though it wasn't figural. She was wary of ego, hero, heights and size. That was the stuff of rooftop eloquence. Admire, but do not emulate. Her daughter was in town, and they walked around the cast-iron district and had lunch in the village, and they shopped a little bit, and it was hard. It was always hard with Teresa. She had an air of deprivation and a plainness that seemed obstinate. She was overweight and willfully unpretty, and seemed to be saying that Daddy loves me exactly the way I am, but my mother doesn't. My mother thinks I can be better and smarter and know better and smarter people. She heard those shots, and then looked up and saw the Cinzano awning, and realized the fringes were flapping on the river wind. Teresa was 25, but looked ageless and shapeless. And the hardest part of the visit for Clara was sitting in the loft talking, or waiting out the silences, or finding out her daughter took sugar in her tea and not having sugar in the house. "You should visit Daddy," Teresa said. And this is spoken as a provocation, a form of censure that has nothing to do with a train ride to the Bronx. "That's not a good idea, trust me."
I can't believe you live in the same city, and you never once.
Frankly, I could live on the same street. It's not a question of where we live, you know? There's nothing to be gained, and he knows it, and I know it. She leaves unsaid the fact that Teresa knows it, too.
Why does something have to be gained? Why is there always this thing of gain?
So many years, Teresa. What's the point? Another silence now of tea things clinking and trucks at the loading platforms along the street. Those trucks with dented metal sides and no company names.
You don't have any sweet and low, even?
Clara looked out the windows at the fire escapes. The backsides of the gray buildings. What a gleaning of sheened iron and rust fungus and scaly brick. How is he? She said.
What? He's all right. He won't move to a new building. That building is getting to be ridiculous that he's in now.
Everywhere they walked, there was garbage stacked in black bags. They were 7 days into the strike, which included a number of violent incidents, and one private hauler nearly beaten to death. Teresa said nothing about the mounds of trash, 50 bags in some places, because she lived in Vermont, and what could she say? But she used the trash against her mother. The trash was another form of accusation. It passed telepathically between them. 100 bags on one corner, and a smell so summer lush it enveloped the whole body, pressing in like a weather system. In the loft, Teresa said,
"He listens to opera all day long, all summer, until school's back in. He wants Aunt Laura to move in with him. She's getting, I don't know, not senile, just a little shaky, Laura. But I think she'd rather live alone."
Clara could hear the drag in her daughter's voice, the old mauled vowels. And how odd to hear these neighborhood noises so close to hand and from her own child, who seemed to exaggerate the slur, the loitering quality of the accent, a form of inflection and pronunciation her father and mother had escaped. That is the word, escaped. As if the young woman needed to go one boundary farther back, one level deeper into the life of the streets, to make some point about constancy and faith. She'd been pulling color out of her work for years. For a while, she used bitumen and house paint. She liked to mix colors in clamshells she'd brought back from Maine 12 years ago. But there was less color to mix now. It felt right for her to pull it out. She walked down to the market past another new gallery. There were galleries and shops now, but the cast-iron facades were safe from the wreckers. That was the main thing. The old factories where immigrants made buttons and suits, women and girls working 18-hour days. And she bought a box of sugar in the market before she forgets, and 10 months go by, and Teresa turns up again. Art in which the moment is heroic. American art. The do-it-now, the fuck-the-past. She could not follow that. She could look at it and respect it, envy it even, in a way, but not herself place hand to object and make some furious now, some brilliant jack-off gesture that asserts an independence. She said to a friend on the phone, her friend and dealer Esther Winship, who was always ready to advise a painter or sculptor, to bully the washy artist into a sound strategy, some plan for clear action, when in fact it was Esther who needed help. Esther and her boss lady trousseau, her pearls and pinstripe suits, who was losing painters and getting squeezed by her landlord uptown and feeling sorry for herself. And she said to Esther on the phone, "Hey, look, I'll start working again if you'll invite me to the country."
"Never mind the country. I want you to take me to the Bronx."
"What's in the Bronx?"
"A kid who does graffiti. He does trains, subways, whole trains. He does every car in a subway train. I want to sign him up and show his work. But I have to find him first."
"How do you show his work?"
"I'll give him a wall," she said.
Clara had to admit she liked the sound of that. Maybe it was the first stage of saying, I'll give him a building. I'll give him a city block. That's the way Esther wanted it to sound. You live longer and sleep better if you can say things like that. I'll give him a train with 100 cars. Why do you need help finding him? I don't know his name. I only know his tag, Moonman 157. Sounds familiar, Clara said. You've seen it. Everybody's seen it. The kid's a goddamn master. She loved the water tanks she saw from the roofs, perched everywhere, old brown wood with tops like coolie hats. They often built the tanks right on site, the way you make a barrel, grooved staves bound with metal hoops. And, of course, the twin towers in the distance, a model of behemoth mass production. Units that roll identically off the line and end up in your supermarket, stamped with the day's prices. Miles was younger than Clara. 8 or 9 years, maybe. And looked even younger than that. So free of responsibility, engagement with real things, that he struck her as an ever-welcome and weightless state. Someone who happens by, almost always late, but it almost never matters kind of person. He was usually in jeans and lizard-skin boots, and he had bad skin and a beautiful bent nose, and wore his hair raked straight back, and lived in a room and a half on the Upper West Side with reels of film and things from his life still packed in boxes. Just things, you know. Stuff you carry with you and keep because it's a form of mind clutter that you're comfortable with. He worked for a movie distributor part-time and also produced documentaries or co-produced or made phone calls. And it was a process that carried just enough slanting light to make it renewably futile. He arranged screenings for a film society as well. And he saw everything, collected movie posters and lobby cards, could recite the filmographies of the obscurest directors, because the more obscure the figure, of course, the more valuable the knowledge. This has always been a point of honor in the business. And this summer he was trying to put together financing for a documentary about a woman who contracted the illnesses and diseases of celebrities. Through some odd form of neurohypnosis, or whatever the term, this woman, who lived in normal Illinois, this made her irresistible, showed the symptoms of whatever illness Elizabeth Taylor was suffering at a particular time, or John Wayne, or Jackie Onassis, or name your star, from a fluey sort of fatigue to the skin eruptions of herpes simplex and the wasted frame of cancer. It was the modern stigmata. And doctors sponsored by the tabloids were studying her. And Miles wanted to title the film, if he could put it together, nice and simple, Normal Illinois. Her hair fell freely to both sides of her face, more or less untended to, sort of chop cut at the bottom and going noticeably gray at the parted top. She had eyes that were set wide and bulged slightly, and her brows slanted away toward her temples. She had a shy look. Not shy, but private. And if you'd seen her alone on a roof that summer, you might have thought twice before sidling up with small talk. It was the summer of sheet lightning and red wine, those deep Bordeaux's that resemble lion's blood. And she stood on rooftops and terraces and wondered how all these things could have been here so long without her ever knowing. She loved the biplane sculpture on a roof downtown. An old mail plane, maybe, full scale, with a landing strip and lights. And the stepped pyramid atop a building on Wall Street. And the machined steel spire of the Chrysler Building. And the south face of the Hotel Pierre, like some scansion of rooftop Paris, only elongated many times, shot versingly skyward. She realized how rare it was to see what stands before you. What a novelty, a basic sensation in the grinding life of the city. To look across a measured space and be undistracted by signs and streetlights and taxis and scaffolding, by your own bespattered mind, sorting the data, and by the energy that hurrying people make, lunch crowds and buses and bike messengers, all that consciousness powering down the flumes of Manhattan, so that it becomes impossible to see across a street to the turquoise tiles of some terracotta facade, a winged beast carved above the lintel. Clara conducted dialogues with her body, reminding herself before she got out of a chair where it was she wanted to go, to the kitchen maybe for a spoon, and exactly how she would have to get there. She needed to locate her body in a situation, tell herself where she was, sometimes looking back as if she might still be sitting in the chair. She had a full mouth that was too bunched and puckered, and also slightly askew, designed to speak asides. And her voice had tonal changes that were interesting. It had dips and hollows and husky undertows. Me and my friend Rochelle, who taught me how to smoke. She had drinks with a few people on a high roof planted with fruit trees and scarlet runner, and they watched a woman jogging on a track on top of an office tower, and it made them all feel happy, the jogger and day-glow sweats, and the medieval turrets in the distance, and the smokestacks beyond that, and then the river lying silky just off Brooklyn. Clara had a slender neck and wore a chain with an amulet from North Africa, a charm against bad luck, which her second husband gave her, Jason, when they were divorced. Miles had a fancy deck of Italian cards and taught her a game called Scopa. They played it late at night after dinner somewhere, and a session in her bed beneath the tall windows of her loft, with the intersecting steps of the fire escapes running a deep perspective down the alleys. He asked her about the stack of floorboards in the far corner. Floorboards, burlap, lengths of rope. She had a former student who gathered materials for her. She had taught a class in sculpture for some years, and one of her young men went to abandoned buildings, to boatyards, glazieries. He scoured the outer boroughs, went to garages and bowling alleys, and came back once with a dozen old pillows from a condemned hotel, stained gray by how many transient heads. Such sad and eerie objects to have around. "You don't mind working and living under one roof?" "It's one thing," she said. "But don't you have to get away from it? All this stuff in here. You can't escape it. It's everywhere. And it's work. And you have to look at it all the time." "I'm lying here with someone whose own abode." "I know, but I don't work there. I talk on the phone at most. That's the actual extent of what I do, work-wise." "We're screening a thing you want to see. Next week, I'll call you."
"Good. The movies."
She loved to swim. She went to the Y nearly every day and stroked invisibly through the water, delivering herself to the laps, the soothing pool lengths, monotonous and restoring, like the rote recitations in early school, stiffens your sense of who you are. "The thing about summer is you feel you have the city to yourself." "I'd like to take a few days in Sagaponack. But Esther wants me to show her the Bronx before she invites me out there." At some point she realized that the card game she played with Miles, the game they played with the expensive deck of attenuated knaves and queens, figures of a certain sinister minimalism, she understood gradually that Scopa was the same game she'd seen boys playing on the stoop of the building where she lived when she was married to Albert. They were Albert's own students, some of them. Mr. Bronzini's boys. And they played the game with an ordinary dog-eared deck, of course, and called it Sweep. "What's in the Bronx?" he said.
"There's a kid she's looking for. Graffiti artist."
"Graffiti writer?" "Well, yes. It's so completely everywhere, this writing." "Tell me when you find him," Miles said.
"What for?"
"I've been thinking about a film where we follow a kid day and night into the paint stores, into the train yards, into the trains."
"Sounds like a film they've already done, even if they haven't."
"They haven't," he said.
"What happened in Normal, Illinois?"
We're going ahead, pushing to get a grant, but she's sick now.
Of course she's sick. This is what she does, isn't it?
I mean sick, independent of other sources, he said. But the laps were more effective when she was busy on a project. She didn't love swimming nearly so much when she was idle. The laps were an attachment to rigorous work, the interval that completes the octave.
This ends Disc 12.